pleasure to join with you. I'd like to thank Robert Shore and Karen Simon for giving me this opportunity. I've had the opportunity to speak at Kollel Yom Rishon a few times, but never at Midreshet Yom Rishon, and it's a pleasure now to see for sure. Where am I? Too close? Oh, only speak into the mic. Okay. Better that way. I said it's a pleasure to be here. It's my first time at Midreshet Yom Rishon. It gives me an opportunity to see where my wife has actually been going over these Sunday mornings. Some of you may be familiar with a story that's told of a lawyer who was unfortunately approached by a woman concerning who wants to hire him to negotiate a divorce. The woman turns to the lawyer, and the lawyer is trying to determine whether or not what exactly the issues are. And he turns to the woman and he says, "Excuse me, ma'am, but do you have any grounds?" And she says, "Yes, we have about an acre and a half." He says to her, "No, you don't quite understand me, but do you have a grudge?" She says, "No, but we have a carport." He said, "I'm having problems here, ma'am. Does your wife beat you up in the morning?" She said, "No, I'm up before him every day." "Ma'am, can you please tell me, therefore, why do you want this divorce?" And she turns to him and says, "No, you don't understand. My husband wants the divorce. He claims we have difficulty communicating." It seems to me every year that there is a failure to communicate when it comes to the holiday of Purim. That Purim fails to communicate to us year after year the very serious lessons that lie at its core. I believe that's because of the overlay that's developed over the years of fun and games and merriment and celebration and children's activities. And we fail to see past that veneer and recognize that perhaps more than any other festival on the Jewish calendar, this festival speaks to our time with tremendous seriousness. And the lessons that it conveys are more critical to us than perhaps almost any other lessons that can be learned. In order to understand, we have to go back historically to determine when is it that Purim actually emerges. Purim emerges on the historical timeline at a critical moment in Jewish history. At a moment when the gullus of force, of gullus Bavel, becomes a gullus of choice. For 70 years, we've been languishing in the exile of Babylon. And for 70 years, we've been praying, Al Naros Bavel, Shom Yashavnu, Gam Bochinu, Shir Amalos, Beshuv Hashem, and Shivat Zion. We're going back. Lishon Abba B'Yerushalayim. Finally, after 70 years, Koresh, Cyrus the Great, conquers the Babylonian Empire, creates the Persian Empire, and gives the Jewish people the opportunity to return to the land of Israel. Less than 10% return. Over 90% say, "We're going to stay right here. It's very comfortable, it's very nice. Let someone else go home and drain the swamps." It is Dafka at that point, some point within those years, when Purim emerges. And it's almost as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu is turning to Klal Yisrael and saying to them, "If this is the world that you're going to choose, then I want you to take a very good look at it. And I want you to understand exactly what you're choosing, all of the dangers that are inherent within it, and all of its challenges. And if you still decide that's what you're going to choose, then at least you'll do it with eyes open." And Purim therefore emerges as a prototypical festival. And let me explain. It's different than any other chag on the Jewish calendar. When it comes to Purim, we are not simply remembering and re-experiencing an event that occurred in the past, but we are marking an event, or a type of event, that occurs and recurs throughout history across the face of Gullus. As proof, open up when you go home, if you have an Encyclopedia Judaica, And take a look at the entry concerning Purim. And you'll find something fascinating. You'll find that after describing the Purim that you and I are familiar with, there will be 2.5 pages, 2.5 pages, a chart of various occasions that were Purim specific to specific locations. The Purim of Algiers, the Purim of Baghdad, the Purim of Florence, of Prague, of Vilna. It goes on and on, scores and scores of Purims. And what were these occasions? These were occasions when those particular communities experienced tremendous challenge, near tragedy, were somehow miraculously saved and decided that they were going to create a holiday to commemorate that occasion, and they called it Purim of Algiers. Because to the Jewish mind, that's what Purim is. Purim is not something that occurs in the past. It's something that occurs with changes, with nuances, different details, but the same paradigm over and over again. And if that's the case, then everything within the holiday of Purim becomes paradigmatic, sets paradigms, creates lessons that we're supposed to look at and we're supposed to recognize speak to the world in which we live. And when I say it speaks to us more clearly than any other chag, consider, we too, after thousands of years, for the first time, live primarily in a galus of choice. The greatest percentage of those who are still living in galut outside the land of Israel are choosing to do so, you and I and others. We have our reasons, we have our explanations, but it's different. It's no longer forced upon us. And therefore, that moment of history when Purim emerges is the closest moment to our own galus experience. And the paradigms that are created by Purim speak most clearly to us. What we're going to do is we're going to journey into that world, into the world which is fundamentally ours. And we're going to look at what Purim has to say about our experiences and some of the lessons that we can learn from it. I've divided, if you take a look at the handouts before you, into two distinct categories. The paradigms of Purim that speak to the setting and the paradigms that speak to the characters. Let's begin with the setting. Three particular characteristics that emerge from the Purim story that speak to the setting of living in a galus of choice. Number one emerges from the Megillah itself, and it's the underlying two words in section one. V'nahafochu asher yishlutu ha'yehudim hema besoneh. V'nahafochu. What do the words mean? Overturns. Change. The first criteria, or the first paradigm of living in a galus experience, is that things can change on a dime. Instantaneous, without warning. Look at the Purim story. When the Megillah opens, Klal Yisrael, according to Chazal, are riding high. They're at the top echelons of Persian society. They are participating with Sudaso Shaloso Rasha. Their own community infrastructure is breaking down. That's another message. That's another concern. But they are riding high. They're on top. Mordechai is in the palace. He's outside the palace. He's well known. Instantaneously, without warning, Haman comes, the favorite of the king, and instantaneously the Jewish nation is threatened with near destruction. Instantaneously, it's overturned again. When you live in galus, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling us nothing is certain. Things can change at a moment's notice, and you may live in a country where you feel secure, and that can change. And we've seen this. We've seen this throughout our history. Speak again to the survivors who remain with us about what it was like in their countries before the Second World War. How they felt secure, how the Jews had reached to the top echelon. Certainly there was prejudice, but could they ever have imagined what would have happened? Chas v'shalom, impossible. Look at, if anything, the changes are speeding up in our world. Fall of the Soviet Union, the changes sweeping across the face of the Arab world today. Who could have predicted this a half a year ago? Things change, And we live in Gomez, and we have to recognize in Hafou, you're handing your fate over to others. Your fate can change undying. Number two
emerges from a very well-known and yet very strange rabbinic observation concerning Purim.
Esther min haTorah minayin, Chazal asked. Esther, how do you know, where is there an allusion to Esther from the Torah? So at face value, it's a very strange question. Centuries before the Torah is written, Esther, what does she have to do with the Torah? The rabbis respond with a pasuk in Dvarim, Va'anochi haster astir ponai bayomahu. Where HaKadosh Baruch Hu warns, I'm going to hide my face on that day. Say the rabbis, look at the words. Esther ponin, astir, Esther, Esther, Esther from the Torah. Very nice, beautiful, lovely medrash. But it, as always, the medrash is saying something that needs to be heard. What the medrash is telling us, of course, is that the nature of existence in Golos is living at a time of Esther ponin. That living, that Purim, is exemplified by a being, a race this time. A hidden miracle. What's missing in the Megillah? What's not written in the Megillah? Shem Hashem. It's not an accident. The challenge of Purim, the specific challenge of Purim, was to recognize the miracle that occurred beyond the curtain. To see within what would seem to be a whole series of coincidences, a miraculous event. To go even further, if one notes the patterns of history, Purim marks the beginning of the non-prophetic era within Jewish history on a national scale. On a national scale, Purim is the beginning of the non- until now, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is speaking. He's speaking to Yechezkel and Golos Babel. Come Purim, God is suddenly silent. And the challenge of Purim is to recognize that which Hashem does beyond or beneath the surface. If one wants to go a step further and look at historical patterns, you can recognize that this has happened before. It's very interesting. Jewish history unfolds twice, really. First with the patriarchal era, the era of the Yochid, and then again with the era of the community, with the birth of the Jewish nation. The same pattern emerged before. At a moment in the patriarchal era, suddenly God stopped speaking. That was with the story of Yosef. Suddenly, HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't speak to Yosef the way he spoke to his father and grandfather and great-grandfather. And Yosef is in Golos. Yosef is the one who's created the Golos. And in fact, Chazal will compare the Yosef story to the Purim story over and over again. Because what happens is HaKadosh Baruch Hu stops speaking at that particular moment. So living in a Golos experience or living in our time is to live in a time of Nes Nistov. It's to live in the time of Hester Pani, and that is what the Purim story is teaching us. Finally, perhaps the most powerful of all of the particular characteristics of the Purim setting is contained in an abundantly strange Mamar Chazal that is often misunderstood and often celebrated in the wrong way. Amar Rava. Mechayev inish livsume bekuria ad lo yoda bein orur hamon lebaruch Mordechai. Says Rava, a person should become so intoxicated that he can no longer tell the difference between orur hamon and baruch Mordechai. That he should no longer be able to tell the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. Now, putting aside the halacha l'maisa, which, believe me, halacha l'maisa does not require us necessarily to become so drunk. There are all sorts, and I urge you to young and old alike, to recognize that. But whatever the halachic perspective here, why would Chazal even suggest something? It runs counter to everything we know about Jewish belief. Jewish belief believes in a sober reflection of God's existence. We don't believe in escapist celebration. Yayin v'shechor al teisht, Aaron and his sons are told that when they're going into the Mishkan. We don't believe in hallucinogenic
worship of HaKadosh Baruch.
Why would there be this out of character statement on the part of Rome?
Because this is the third component of the Purim setting.
When you live in the world of Purim, you live at a time when the distinction between Aruch Haman and Baruch Mordechai is not being made for you. You live in a world where those lines are blurred. You live in a world which tells you that right is wrong, and wrong is right, and left is right, and right is left. You live in a world where Libya can be sitting on the UN Council of Human Relations and Human Rights, and the UN can turn to you and say, this is normal, we're normal, that's right, this is a normal thing, cannot be normal. Normal, you should be the chairman of the Council of Human Rights. And you will look at it, and I will look at it, and we think normal people will look at it and say, what is this? It means to live in a world where country after country that persecutes its citizens, that treats minorities and women and others with tremendous disdain, they're the ones that are criticizing over and over again one small country in the Middle East for being the problems of the entire world. No distinction between Aruch Haman and Baruch Mordechai. And in such a world, you have to create that distinction. But first, you have to recognize the world in which you live, and that's what Chazal are saying. That you're living in a world where those distinctions are not being made. It also means that there are certain challenges you have, because sometimes it's not, those distinctions won't even be clear to you, and you're going to have to map out your own strategies. For example, how is it that we as a people should be in our day responding to the wave of democratization that's sweeping across the Arab world? On the one hand, we should respond as people who believe in democracy. On the one hand, we should say that no people should ever be persecuted and have to live under the sway of a tyrant. At the same time, we look at it from Jewish eyes and we say, yes, democracy. But at the same time, we will hold whatever democracy you create accountable for the morality that you will create with it as well. How do we deal with Islamic fundamentalism and terror here in the States? Yes, we as Jews should absolutely say that there is no particular group should be isolated and prejudiced against simply because of the way they believe. We've experienced that ourselves. At the same time, we have a right to turn to the Islamics and to say to them, in how many mosques over the course of this past weekend, in how many mosques was the attack on an innocent family this past week, on this past day, how many mosques was that committed? How many imams stood up and said, we as a people will not accept and as a religion will not accept that kind of act? It had the reverse been true, Chas v'Shalom? And we know this, we've seen it. Had an Israeli committed a terror attack of this type, it would have been condemned in shuls across the world. We have a right to expect the morality that we expect from ourselves, from others. And that's what it means to live in a world of Anlo Yoda, to demand and to map out responses that are appropriate and careful and loud. So those are some of the characteristics of living in a plural world that emerge from the story itself and create the environment in which we live. An environment of Vinafohu, an environment of Hester Ponim, an environment of Atlo Yoda. Purim even goes further. And here it, I believe, really gets fascinating. Each of the characters in the Purim story, I would suggest, is also a paradigm. The four major characters, Haman, Mordechai, Esther, and we will see in most depth, Ahasuerus. These are four paradigms. They are real people in a real story that occurred. But every one of them represents a figure that will populate Jewish history across the face of history. And their story is repeated in different eras, with different details, over and over again. These are people you and I will meet and do meet throughout Jewish history. Let's start with the easiest and the most devastating, perhaps. Haman. All right, give me one word. Who does Haman represent? Amalek. Amalek. How do we know that? Haman ha'Agogi. Haman, the descendant of Agog, the king of Amalek. Well, what is the characteristic of Amalek? Take a look, if you will, at source number 4 on your pages. Zachor es asher asah lecha Amalek b'derech b'tzeischem mimitzrayim. Remember what Amalek did to you? We're going to read this Shabbos. B'derech b'tzeischem mimitzrayim, on the path as you left Egypt. Asher korcha b'derech. What did Amalek do? Korcha b'derech. Now, that's a very strange word. What does the word korcha come from? I'll tell you the Medrash, but then we're going to look at Pshat. Medrash says that it's related to the word kar, and that when we left Egypt, we were hot. Nobody was willing to attack us. And then what does Amalek do? Well, it's like if you have a vat of boiling water and you throw something in it, it cools it off. Amalek has the temerity to attack us, and once Amalek attacks us, we become colder and others can attack us as well. Very nice. It's not Pashup Shad. What is Pashup Shad of the word Karcha? Anyone want to suggest? Excellent. Correct. Comes from the word Mikreh. Asher Karcha Baderech, they happened upon you on the way. So what is the characteristic of Amalek? Characteristic of Amalek is you are not attacking him. You are not traveling through his land. You were leaving him alone entirely. And he attacks you. He attacks you for no reason. His hatred is baseless. It's irrational. Korcha b'derech. That is Amalek. Vayezane b'cha. Who does he attack? Kolan echesholim acharecha. And he attacks the weak. He attacks the defenseless. So Amalek is, within the span of Jewish history, the enemy who hates the Jew, whose hatred is for no reason, irrational, and there's nothing you can do about it other than defend yourself. Look at how the Megillah represents Haman. Next section. Vayivez ve'edah. Let me just set the stage. Mordechai refuses to bow down to Haman. Vayibez ve'enov lishloach hayod b'Mordechai levado ki gido lo es am Mordechai ve'yavakesh Haman lahashmir es kol ha'yudim asher b'chol malchus achashverosh am Mordechai. A normal evil person. Someone who's not insane. Mordechai doesn't bow down to you. You're a normal evil person. What do you decide you're going to do? Kill Mordechai. Mordechai doesn't bow down to you. You kill Mordechai. Amalek. Mordechai doesn't bow down to me. He's a Jew. Kill all the Jews. Even from Haman's perspective, it makes no sense. It's irrational. There's no rhyme or reason to this. Now, the Medrash will give you all sorts of stories, but Pashup Shad, it's very clear, that's why Haman is Amalek. Let's go to the second character. Who is Mordechai? What paradigm does Mordechai represent? Anyone want to suggest it? Well, Mordechai is the hero. Right? Mordechai is the saving person who heroically saves the Jewish people. But, as with all of these figures, there are complexities. Mordechai's heroism is not necessarily so simple to understand. Take a look, and I knew the issue I was going to speak about, but I noticed it in text as I was preparing for this class. Take a look at what section 6 reads. Kol Avdei HaMelech, Asher B'Shar HaMelech, Korim U'Mishtachavim, they're all bowing down to to Haman, Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachar. Mordechai refuses to bow down. Look at sentence Dalet. Well, sentence Gimel. Vayomer Ohav ve'amelech asher v'shar amelech le'mordechai mu'adu atol ve'aranit. Why are you? They all turn to him and say, why are you not obeying the rule of the king? Vahi ba'amram ka'amram aylov yom v'yom v'lo shama v'yagiru l'haman l'ros hayamdu devor Mordechai ki gid lohem asher hu Yehudi. So they decide they're going to watch and see, right? We're going to see whether or not this is, Mordechai is going to be successful. Somebody explain those last words to me. What does that have to do with anything? He gid lo asher hu Yehudi. This is much more than just simply watching to see whether Mordechai is going to bow down. We want to see whether the Jew is going to manage here. What's going to happen to the Jew? He gid lo asher hu Yehudi. So let me ask you a question, halachically. If you live in a country and there's a king, and the king says it is law of the land that you should bow down to the king, what's the halacha? You bow down to the king. Yes. Under normal circumstances, if you are in a country and that is the law of the land, you have to show respect to the king. And if it means bowing down, now we're not talking about kneeling, but bowing down to the king is absolutely allowed and mandated. Why then does Mordechai bow down to Haman? Why not? If you bow down to a king, and if the king says now you must bow down to my servant or my emissary, and that is the law of the land. Now this isn't my question, by the way. This question is asked in the Gemara. The Gemara says, why doesn't Mordechai bow down to the king? Now, if you take a look at the text, the question becomes even greater. He's not only endangering himself, the text is saying, but they all know that this is going to become an issue of what? The Jews. If all those who are watching this are watching, this is going to be fun. Let's watch and see what happens to the Jew and to the Jewish people. So therefore, Mordechai, by refusing to bow down to Haman, is not only endangering himself, but endangering those around him. So why doesn't he bow down? Okay, fine. So what you said is maybe he realizes the greater issue. Let me tell you how the Gemara answers it, and then I'll tell you how I believe that your interpretation is right. The Gemara says that Haman was wearing an avodah zarah around his neck, and that if Mordechai would have bowed down to Haman, he would have been bowing down not just to Haman, but he would have been bowing down to the idolatry represented by Haman. Now, I believe that what the Gemara is saying, and again, we can argue whether you have to take Midrashim literally or not. I'm a firm believer that Midrash is often figurative in trying to teach you something. I don't know that it's literally that we have a avodah zarah around this name. I believe what the Gemara is saying is that he represented something much greater. That Mordechai understood that there are red lines, and that there are certain red lines over which you cannot cross even at great cost, because the cost of crossing those lines is even greater. And he looks at Haman and he says, I cannot bow down to this man. Why? Because what he represents, knowing Haman, is someone or something that if I bow down to that, I'll be selling my soul. I will be endangering myself and my people in a much greater fashion than I will be endangering them if I don't bow down. Once we bow down to Haman, we will, who knows, I can create scenarios. We will assimilate into Persian culture. We're bowing down to someone like that. We're bowing down to his avodah zarah. We're bowing down to who he is.
At some point, if you don't draw your red lines, then you lose the whole game. And that's the job of the Jewish leader. That's the job of the Jewish hero. That's the job of the Jewish community. To determine what are your red lines beyond which you can't go, even at great danger and at great cost. And that's what Mordechai is doing. It's a very complicated story, and it's not easy. And it's true in our, what are the things in our society that we can bow down to? What are the things in our society that we can accept or that we must reject? You know, I get on my rabbinic soapbox for a moment here. You know, there, three of my children will not have televisions in their homes out of my home. Now, if I had 10 or 20 years ago, somebody would have said to me, you don't have a television in your home, I'd say you're crazy. You're a real right-wing fanatic. You know what? After seeing what's on television today, you can't bow down to 90% of it. You can't allow it in your home. I understand those decisions. What are the red lines? What are the things that you feel you can or cannot have it, and bowing down to means accepting? That's what Mordechai cannot accept a Haman at great cost. At great cost. All right. What about Esther? Number three. Who would you say Esther represents as a paradigm in the story of the Jewish people? Again, she's a heroine, but she's much more than that.
What's somebody?
Henry.
She represents sorrow. Why? Because she can. Okay. All right, she represents someone who can live in the royalty like sorrow and not be affected. But I'm not looking for a particular person. I'm looking for a paradigm. She does the action. I'll tell you what else. I'll tell you what I think she is. She's Cassie. She's the martyr. She's the martyr. Let's understand something. At the end of the Megillah, everybody's out celebrating in the streets from the Jewish community except for who? Esther. What happens to Esther? Esther remains a Persian queen. Esther gives birth to Darius, to a Persian king. She's gone. She's no longer a part. We remember her. Right? But could her children, after a few generations, go on Aliyah and be accepted by the Rabbanut? Let's not get involved in the politics. The answer is no. She's lost to the Jewish nation. And the Gemara says that. There's one point in the Megillah. When you hear these words, you should cry. She turns to Mordechai, and Mordechai says, and it's on the next page, right? Yeah, I mean, not the next page, it's section number 7, the next section. And Mordechai says, you have to go to the king. And she argues, I can't go to the king, and we'll get back to that in a moment. And she says, and Mordechai says, you have to, and if you don't, then you'll be lost, da, 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 da. And she says, Ha'asher avadeti, avadeti. She says, fine. But you know what? Something's happening now for the first time. Until now, I could claim force. With whatever, and by the way, the Gemara has a whole debate about how Esther, could allow herself to go into the palace, whether she was halachically correct and what right she had, and there's a whole debate. But one thing is clear, at least until this moment, she did not do it voluntarily. At this moment, when she says, I'm going to initiate a conference with the king, and let's understand, when you have a conference with the king, you're not just having king trumpets. Let's not sanitize this. You're going because you're part of the harem. When she initiates, she turns to Mordechai and she says, Kasher avadati avad, which means, as I am lost to you, says the Gemara, I am lost to my people. That's it. This is the line. And Esther emerges as someone who sells her soul to save the Jewish people. It's a terribly sad story. They don't recognize it.
And how many Jews across the face of history have given their lives, physically, spiritually, to save the Jews? And here, that's what we're dealing with when we talk about Esther. Esther is the martyr. But I think perhaps the most interesting character of all, and one of the most powerful paradigms, is the last character, Ahasuerus. Here is a character that we learn about as children, and we see in unidimensional fashion, and he is a very, very complicated man. Tell me, what do we know? What were we taught about Ahasuerus?
Loves the party.
Loves the party.
What else? Smart?
Stupid.
Not smart. Right? Very. There is a debate in the Talmud.
Ahasuerus tipesh hayah?
Opikeach hayah. Was Ahasuerus dumb? Or was he clever? Was he smart? Was he cunning? And the debate is left open for conversation. And there is, by the way, another tradition of the Gemara that Ahasuerus was someone who conquered the throne. He was not a Nevesh. He is a man who led a revolution and conquered the throne. So, not so simple. So is he a Pekeach or is he a Tipesh?
As with all rabbinic disputes, when it comes to halacha at least, I believe Eilu Ve'elu Yireelu Kimhayim.
Ahasuerus, I believe, if you look at the Megillah, was a very smart man. Who made himself dumb. What do I mean by that? He is the paradigm of a world that doesn't care. He is the paradigm of a king who is willing to allow anything to happen to his subjects as long as it does not want touch him. As long as it doesn't touch his palace or his house. And as such, he emerges in many ways. Chazal will say he hated the Jews more than all. He emerges as the evil that can allow a Haman to flourish, as the world that can allow that evil to exist. Follow with me. Look at the hints in the Megillah. And here we're looking at Pashut Shat of the text. Take a look at number 8. Haman comes to the king and says, I want to kill all the Jews. They decide to have a lottery, right? They decide that on such and such a date, such and such a time, a year from now or so, what are we going to do? What are we going to allow to happen? A pogrom. A planned pogrom against the Jews. And we're going to announce it today. Section 8. Haratzim yatsu dechufim bidvar ha-melech. Vehados nidno b'shushan habiro. This edict was given and announce Vehamelech Vahaman Yashru Lishtos Vehair Shushan Navocho. Picture the king and Haman sit down to party, and what's happening outside? Imagine for a moment what it means to a society. Forget about the Jews, the society itself. If today the society were announced, a year from now there is going to be an opportunity for you to kill everyone with blue eyes. The place would go crazy. The whole society begins to, what's going, how are we going to live for the next year? What are we going to do? We're going to walk down the street, we're going to see a Jew. Just wait a couple months, we'll take care of you. What does it mean? The whole society is in an uproar. And what are Haman and Ahasuerus doing? That's nice. It's like you throw a grenade over the wall of the palace walls, let it bounce and reverberate, then you just sit back and have a party. But then it gets better. Look at the next statement. U'Mordechai yodo as asher naso v'yikra Mordechai es begodom v'yubash sach ve'efer. So Mordechai hears what's happening and he dresses in sackcloth and he comes throughout the city and he's calling until he gets to where? Shar HaMelech. Why? Ki ein lovo el Shar HaMelech bilvush somer. Because you can't come into the king's grounds with sackcloth, with mourning.
Now, I suppose you could just pass that off and say you have to be dressed in a tuxedo and see the king.
But there's another way to understand that phrase. What is the Megillah telling us? You got a problem? Keep it out there. There were benevolent kings.
There were kings who had audiences with their subjects, like you.
Right? They would line up, they would come to them, they would not Ahasuerus. You got Sakva Efer, I'm sorry, outside. To a point that becomes absurd. Let's think of what we accept in the Megillah. Look at the next statement. What does Esther say when Mordechai says to her, I go to the king? She says, I can't go to the king because the king has a rule. What's his rule? That he does not want to see anyone unless he himself assigns it.
And if someone shows up who isn't called, what are you going to do? You kill him.
Unless he does not. Wouldn't it be nice to wake up in the morning
and say, you know, babe, I only want to see these people. Anybody else, I don't want to see anyone else. I don't want to.
Now, this doesn't just refer to the subjects outside. This refers to who? His advisors? To the queen? Right? I want to plan my day, and the way I plan my day is I'll see so-and-so and so-and-so and not see anyone else. And if anyone else shows up to ruin my day, so kill them. They won't ruin my day anymore. What kind of monarch are we speaking about? We are speaking about a man who opens the Megillah with his opulent party. We're speaking about a man who loves to party, but it's not just that he loves to party. He wants to live in a fantasy world.
He wants to live in the world of his own creation where whatever occurs outside the walls doesn't touch me.
This is the way I want my world to be, and I will orchestrate it as such. Gets better. Take a look at section number 10. Now, I want you to follow with me carefully what happens. It's the second party. Esther now reveals to Ahasuerus exactly what Haman is planning. So follow the psukim. Vayomer HaMelech Ahasuerus, Vayomer Esther, section number 10. Mi hu zeh v'yeh hu. Who is this? Asher malo libo lasos came. Who is this? Vatomer Esther Tsar va'oyev. It's Haman, right? V'Haman nivas milifnei haMelech v'Hamak. V'Hamelech Melech kom v'Hamaso minishtei hayayin el ginas habison. So what happens? Stay with me. Picture it. Esther and Haman are at a party. Esther points to Haman and says, this is the man who's threatened.
What does the king do?
He runs away. Runs away. Goes out to the bar. What's going on? What's the king's problem here? This is horrible. All the things that I thought were happening out there are happening here. Oh my God, it's invading my palace. So what do? I run away. I can't deal with this. Then what happens? Follow through. Haman Amad Levake Shal Nafsho Me Esther Amalko. So what does Haman sees disaster and begins to, and he falls in front of Esther. V'hamelech shav miginas abison. The melech comes back. V'haman nofel al amito asher esto aleo v'yomer ha-melech ha-gam lichbosh es ha-malko imi ba-boyes. What does Ahasuerus accuse someone of doing? Attempting to seduce Esther.
Now, men are beasts. We'll accept that. But tell me something. Do you really think that Ahasuerus believes that the only thing on Haman's mind right now is seducing the queen? Crazy. What is Ahasuerus doing? He's changing the issue. He's turning it into something he can deal with. Right? I don't want to deal with that. This works. This works. Haman is trying to seduce the queen. What do? Kill Haman. That works. Then I don't have to deal with all the rest of the stuff that the mess we've created out there. Now all I have to do with is that Haman is trying to seduce the queen. So I rewrite the script. I make it something I can deal with. It's an attack on my queen. It's an attack on my monarchy. I'll kill him.
And turn to the next page. Sure enough, he kills Haman. And look at Perek Ches, section 11. Vatosef Esther vatidaber lifnei amelech. Vatipo lifnei ranglo. Vatech vatischanen lo. My gosh, what's going on here? Esther is saying, I know that as far as the king is concerned, what? So, well, everything's fine now. So she has to come to the king, and by the way, this is probably the most dangerous moment for Esther in the whole game. Because the king has to make a choice here. Either he deals, basically what Esther is saying is,
if I can put it in different terms, I'm not going to leave you alone. It's either me or them. Either you, I'm going to keep pleading with you and crying to you. Why? Because you haven't taken care of the problem. They're still going to kill my people. And here's where the real miracle occurs, as far as I'm concerned. Because under normal circumstances, what would Ahasuerus do? He'd say, goodbye to you too. But he loves her. And he therefore insists and he listens. And but she has to plead. She knows if she leaves Ahasuerus alone at this moment, he will act true to form. So now comes the real evil. The real evil. Because again, we read the Megillah and we don't think about what's being said. So the king says, okay, Esther, I'll take care of it. But how are we going to take care of it? Look at the last line on the page. Last line in this section. Va'atem kisu ala Yehudim ketov b'neichem b'shem ha-melech v'chisu b'tabas ha-melech k'kisav asher nikhtov b'shem ha-melech v'nachtom b'tabas ha-melech in lohoshim. So a normal king would say we made a mistake or changed our mind. And what we'll do is we will send out a fine Esther, we'll send out a thing, the pogrom is called off. Ahasuerus won't do that. Because to do that will admit that he made a mistake or changed his mind. So what is the solution? The Jews can defend themselves. That's the solution. Now that sounds nice, but what does it mean? It means that I as a king am mandating civil war in my own country. Go ahead and kill each other. That's fine. Just leave me alone. Here's where the evil of Ahasuerus emerges in for total view. The solution is go kill each other. Jews kill non-Jews, non-Jews kill Jews, blood streaming through the streets of Shushan. Guess what? I'll have a party. I'll be safe here because Haman's gone, nobody's bothering me, me and Esther will have a party. And you begin to realize what Ahasuerus represents. Ahasuerus represents the world that's silent during a Holocaust. Ahasuerus represents those who are willing to allow things to occur as long as, but he represents it at the highest level, not only allow things to occur, but agree, mandate, for those things to occur.
This is a king who cares nothing about his subjects. He only cares. And that kind of figure is the figure that allows for all of this to occur. And we've met people like that close to the face of all of us. But perhaps the most damaging element of this whole scenario, and I think one of the most powerful moments in the Megillah, is in section 12. Because what's the danger of living in such a world? What's the danger of living in a world of Ahasuerus as the orchestrator, Haman as the villain, and all of these things that swirl around us? Well, the danger, of course, is that we'll become a victim. There's another danger. Take a look at section 12. Let me paint the scene again. Mordechai is coming to Esther and saying, you have to go speak to the king. And Esther says, no, I can't. If I go there, the king will kill me. If you're Mordechai, what would you then say to Esther? If you're Mordechai, and she has just said, I can't, the king will kill me, what would you say? How can you not? Your people are going to die. Your life isn't the issue. Look at what Mordechai says. Vayagidu l'Mordechai is Kedrei Esther. Vayomer Mordechai lo Ashidav Esther. Al tidami benafsheich lihimolei beis hamelech mikol hayehudim. What's he saying to her? Don't think you're safe. Don't think you're safe. And only after he says that does he then say, Kimacharesh Takarishi Boisani Revak Batsolo Yamod Mayudi Mimokom Acher, because if you're quiet, we're gonna be saved and you'll be lost. But what's his initial response and what's his fear? You know what his fear is? That Esther, living in the palace of Ahasuerus, has started to become like Ahasuerus. That when you live in such a world, the danger is not just that you're going to become a victim. The danger is that you're going to become a predator. The danger is that you're going to assimilate that culture into yourself without even realizing. And he's afraid. That's why he pulls her back. He starts off by saying, you're not safe. Then once he has her attention, he then begins to talk to her the way he should talk to her. For there's a famous story that Elie Wiesel says, it's one of his beautiful vignettes, where he talks about the just man who comes to Sodom. And as soon as he arrives in Sodom, he rails out against all the injustice that he sees. And he does this one year, and the next year, and the next year, and the year after that, he keeps doing it until finally, after 30 years of making absolutely no difference whatsoever, a little child comes up to him and says, you crazy man. You've been doing this for 30 years. For 30 years, and you've made no difference at all. Why are you still yelling? And the man looks and says, you know, when I first came here, I screamed because I wanted to change them. Now I'm screaming because I want to stop them from changing me. And that's the message that comes here. That when you live in such a world, you've got to be very careful. Not just that you become a potential victim, but that slowly you can assimilate those characteristics into yourself, and you can become a perpetrator, God forbid, as well. So in the final analysis, perhaps we've shown today, and we'll leave the last section out for now, perhaps we've shown that the journey into the world of Purim is not just a journey into a world that informs our own world, but it's a journey into our world. It's a journey into a godless world where the criteria of the settings apply, where the personalities are people that we meet. And this holiday should speak to us this year in a critical way, informing our lives. Thank you.